Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. Pope Francis has urged Kenya's leaders Wednesday to work with transparency to ensure fair distribution of national resources as criticism grows over runaway graft in the East African country. He said, "I encourage you to work with integrity and transparency for the common good and to foster a spirit of solidarity at every level of society." The Pope made the comments after arriving in the capital of Nairobi at the start of a three-nation tour. His schedule in Nairobi includes meetings with President Uhuru Kenyatta and his group of diplomats at the State House. Correspondent Jill Craig is in the Kenyan capital and says security for the Pope's visit is high.
The reports that we got from the Kenyan police chief was 10,000 additional police had been brought in for this event. And you can notice that you see it as well around. I mean, normally at a traffic roundabout, you'd have probably four policemen, sort of directing traffic. And now you've got double that, plus more police along the route. And then also many of the streets are closed down entirely based on wherever the Pope is going. So I would say that that the Kenyan security forces say that they've got things under control.
Again, that is correspondent Jill Craig. The Islamic State group has claimed responsibility for Tuesday's bombing of a bus carrying members of Tunisia's elite presidential guard that killed at least 12 people. In a statement posted on social media Wednesday, the Islamic State said a militant carried out the attack, infiltrating the bus and killing almost 20 apostates. The bus was traveling in the center of the Tunisian capital of Tunis. You can read more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. The United Nations welcomed a peace agreement signed by two tribes in southern Libya and reiterated its calls for the approval of a national pact to end more than a year of political crisis in the country. Qatar brokered the deal between the Tuareg and Tibu tribes in the town of Ubari, and the state-run QNA news agency said it includes a permanent ceasefire and the return of displaced people to their homes. A joint statement between the two sides urged all Libyans to reconcile and work together to build their country. U.S. President Barack Obama says his administration is taking every possible step to keep our homeland safe as millions of Americans travel for a national holiday. Mr. Obama spoke to reporters Wednesday at the White House after meeting with his national security team for a briefing on homeland security that was held in the wake of the deadly terror attacks in Paris 2 weeks ago.
Watching the events in Paris made the threat feel closer to home. So as we go into Thanksgiving weekend, I want the American people to know is that we are taking every possible step to keep our homeland safe. First, we're going after ISIL wherever it hides. That's been our strategy for more than a year. I'll speak about this in more detail in the coming weeks, but let me remind the American people of what our coalition of some 65 nations is doing to destroy these terrorists and defeat their ideology. So far, our military and our partners have conducted more than 8,000 airstrikes on ISIL strongholds and equipment. Those airstrikes, along with the efforts of our partners on the ground, have taken out key leaders, have taken back territory from ISIL in both Iraq and Syria.
Again, that is President Obama speaking to reporters Wednesday at the White House. You can read more details on the president's comments at voanews.com. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has warned that ongoing Israeli-Palestinian violence could spin out of control. And he made that statement after a diplomatic trip to the region where he met with leaders from both sides. Kerry said Wednesday after flying to Boston that the U.S. has been encouraging Israel and the Palestinians to take steps to reduce tensions and demonstrate a true commitment to the two-state solution. A Russian airman who survived the downing of his warplane says Turkish jets did not issue any warnings. He said Wednesday on Russian television that his plane was flying over Syrian territory and didn't violate Turkish airspace. He was rescued early Wednesday by Russian and Syrian commandos and was speaking in televised comments from an airbase in Syria. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yves Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
You know, there were people dancing, there were people singing Catholic worship songs. Traffic was completely stopped, so people were standing on top of minibuses, sort of standing on top of the motorbike, hoping to get a glimpse of the Pope as he came by.
That's Jill Craig from Nairobi reporting. Details next.
Also in the news, the director of one of the few remaining independent newspapers in Burundi is being charged with conspiring with the leaders of a failed coup.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Pope Francis has arrived in Kenya for the first stop of his three-nation tour. He's also scheduled to visit Uganda and the Central African Republic. VOA correspondent Jill Craig was on hand in Nairobi when the Pope arrived. She spoke to Joe DiCapua about what she saw.
Probably thousands of Kenyans who had lined the route from the airport to State House, where the Pope was headed to after he landed. People were very, very excited. I mean, even non-Catholics, non-Christians, very excited the Pope had chosen Kenya as the first stop on his first Africa tour. You know, there were people dancing, there were people singing Catholic worship songs. Traffic was completely stopped, so people were standing on top of minibuses, sort of standing on top of the motorbikes, hoping to get a glimpse of the Pope as he came by. So I can tell you the mood was very, very festive. The other thing I noticed was that each time a car would come by, for example, when the police motorcade or when even an ambulance or a police car would drive by, people were cheering, you know, I think just sort of thinking, oh, the Pope is coming next. So I can say that everyone was very excited. And when the Pope did roll by, you know, he was waving and people were just very, very jubilant. So I can say that Kenyans are pretty excited about this visit.
What are the main issues that the Pope is expected to discuss?
Many of the same issues that he did in D.C., although I will say that there's a few other ones for Kenya. He's expected to address climate change, which, as you know, he mentioned several times on his U.S. tour, and so he will be stopping by the United Nations Environment Program tomorrow, actually, to talk with officials there. So climate change is one issue. He's going to be talking with a group of interreligious leaders as well. So we've got Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, Jews, and Protestants, well, Catholics, will be meeting with him tomorrow. And then also he's got a stop scheduled in the Kangeni slum on Friday morning. And that one I think is particularly poignant here because the Pope has made his humility such a founding part of his papacy. And, you know, I think that the way that he has sort of lived a more humble lifestyle really appeals to a lot of people here who are experiencing poverty firsthand. So the fact that he's going to a slum with, I think it's an estimated 200,000 people live in Kangeni in a very crowded, congested, smaller space, relatively speaking. You know, that means a lot to people there. And when I spoke with some of them the other day, the funny thing is when you ask them, how is the Pope doing, instead of talking about the bigger issues of what he's done, you know, a lot of people mention that they're thankful because the government has come in and paved the roads and their security is better because of the immediate impact from the Pope coming. So I think that there's a lot of reasons why people are excited about him coming.
That was VOA correspondent Jill Craig from Nairobi. She spoke with Joe DiCapua.
Pope Francis is scheduled to arrive in the Central African Republic Sunday, the final stop on his Africa tour. The country has been in chaos since a rebel coup in 2013 that led to bloody intercommunal violence pitting Muslims against Christians. Many hope the Pope can bring peace to the country. VOA's Chris Stein reports from Bangui.
The call to prayer rings out from a mosque in Bangui's PK5 neighborhood. The sound is rarely heard in the capital these days. Most of Bangui's mosques were destroyed in sectarian violence that erupted in December 2013 and continues to simmer even now. Pope Francis is expected to visit this mosque, a perhaps risky venture. Anti-Muslim militia groups, known as the Anti-Balaka, surround the neighborhood, stationed at the entrances and exits with guns and grenades. Inside PK5 are members of the former Seleka rebel group, which took control of the country in March 2013, only to lose power the following year as the country descended into chaos. The conflict has killed thousands and displaced nearly a million more. Most of the country's Muslim minority fled to neighboring countries amid mob violence, held responsible for abuses by the mostly Muslim Seleka rebels. PK5 is now the last place in the capital where Muslims can live, but they live under siege. Umar Kobin Layama is a prominent imam in the capital who has worked alongside Christian leaders for reconciliation.
Nous sommes optimistes pour que cette visite puisse apporter un grand changement dans le cœur.
He says he is optimistic that the Pope's visit can change the mentality of the Central African people. He says he wants Muslims and Christians to be able to live together again, which will lead to the development of the country. Across town, Bangui's Cathedral is getting a new coat of paint, under the watchful eye of United Nations peacekeepers and local police. The Pope is expected to administer reconciliation to young people here and hold a prayer vigil. Mary Albertine Ndoitua, a rural development worker, just attended an outdoor prayer service. People are expecting peace, she says. And if the Pope comes, she says she expects peace to come to the land. But others are not so sure. Student Constantine Nguinda says if everyone is united, then the situation can change. But it is not as simple as the Pope coming and then everyone deciding to live in peace. Stalled disarmament has undermined efforts to stabilize the country. Violence has flared sporadically in the capital ahead of much-delayed elections, now planned for December 27th. Bangui has been quiet in recent weeks, but the tension remains high. 22 people were killed in fighting in the countryside earlier this month. Chris Stein for VOA News, Bangui.
Thank you, Chris. In related news, the staff, faculty, and students at the Catholic University of South Sudan are closely following the Pope's historic visit. Father Matthew Pagan, Vice Chancellor of the University, says this is more than a visit. He says it could mark a new beginning for initiatives for goodness and peace for Africa and South Sudan in particular. He spoke with Ayen Bior of the South Sudan In Focus program.
You know, Pope Francis has been very strong on the issues of peace, and he has really talked hard about the question of violence. Violence as a violation of the dignity of human person created in the image of God, and how the people who are really committing violence are really working on the side of evil. They are not promoting anything of God and anything of human progress. He has been very strong on that, and the issues of violence. In one of the statements, he says, violence disfigures the image of God in the human person. Yeah. So we are very happy that he's coming, and he's coming to really boost the initiative for peace, both in various places in East Africa, but in particular in our country, South Sudan.
What does the Pope and his leadership mean for a country like South Sudan?
Oh, it's a big sign of encouragement and hope. The presence of the Pope always brings us a renewed hope of that things can get better. You know, I compare it to a visit of John Paul II in Khartoum, when he came to Khartoum in 1993. You know, for us who were in Khartoum at the time, suffering from the war and all the problems we faced in Khartoum, the coming of the Pope was a new beginning. A new beginning for us in Khartoum, and from that time onward, things began to improve for us who lived the events in Khartoum at the time. This is our hope also, that the coming of the Pope will also mark a new beginning for the East African countries, for South Sudan in particular. That will mark a new beginning, it will mark a new boost for all the initiatives for goodness, initiatives for well-being. Now in our countries, and the initiatives for peace in our country, in particular South Sudan.
What do you think is the biggest lesson that the Pope can take from the people of South Sudan and from the history of South Sudan itself?
I think the biggest thing is really perseverance that the Pope can take from. Our people, if you see our history, the whole history of perseverance, since I don't know, you go back to how many years behind. Yeah. Perseverance and resilience. People suffer, but they are always patient, and the people who never lose hope that things can change better.
The Pope has faced criticism from many who think that he is too progressive and lenient on social issues like divorce and homosexuality. Do you worry that this will shadow his efforts to connect with the African people, in particular South Sudanese?
I think the most important issue now with us is the question of the family that has displaced children, that have got children dying from war, that have got people dying from sicknesses. I think that is not the real message. The real message is the human person born in the family and the children, the women, all these people who are suffering. I think that's what he will focus, the refugees who are in the camps, the people who are dying of hunger, the people who are sick in hospitals and they don't have medicine, the people who are in displaced camps and they don't have medical attention. I think these are like the issues really the Pope will focus on.
That was Father Matthew Pagan, Vice Chancellor of the Catholic University of South Sudan. He was speaking with Ayan Bior of the South Sudan in Focus program.
Police in Europe have been on high alert since the Paris terrorist attacks, but some worry that austerity cuts following the Great Recession may have affected security. Since the attacks, a number of governments have announced new spending plans for intelligence and counterterrorism programs. One analyst says a massive realization hit European politicians following the Paris attacks. France currently has 250,000 police officers, but that figure represents a cut of 13,000 that occurred under the previous governments. In Belgium, where security forces continue to hunt suspects from the Paris attacks, officials have decided not to reduce the number of police officers. Italy, Spain, and England have reduced the number of police officers in recent years.
The Canadian government says it will settle about 25,000 Syrian refugees from Middle Eastern camps within the next 3 months. Newly elected Liberal Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has pledged to settle the first 10,000 by the end of December. However, he's being urged to extend the deadline given security issues after the attacks in Paris. With the help of the UN Refugee Agency, the Canadian government plan is to conduct security checks in Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey. More than 4 million have fled Syria since the start of the conflict in 2011. Most of the migrants and refugees flooding into Europe are Syrians. EU Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker says Europe must not confuse extremists who have attacked Paris with the more than 700,000 migrants and refugees who have come to Europe this year. Juncker favors settlement of asylum seekers for compassionate reasons. He also says there are economic reasons. The entry of thousands of people has damaged free passage of citizens between EU states. But the EU president says without those freedoms of movement, the EU's single currency system will make no sense. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden is attending a summit of southeastern EU countries today in Zagreb, Croatia. The refugee flows, now up to 5,000 per day, have created tension and occasional violence in Greece, Macedonia, Serbia, Croatia, and Slovenia in recent weeks. In related news, at least 18 migrants died in a refugee camp in Algeria yesterday. More than 37 others were injured as a fire broke out in the camp in southern Algeria. The cause of the fire has not been determined. Many in the camp have fled from poverty and terrorist threats in Mali and Niger.
A new UN initiative has been launched to respond to the growth of violent extremism in Africa. It's estimated that since 2011, more than 21,000 people have died in over 4,000 terrorist attacks on the continent. VOA's Judy Kapawa reports.
Militant groups such as Al-Shabaab, Boko Haram, and Islamic State have been successful in recruiting young people into their ranks. The result has been spreading violence and death, usually among innocent civilians. The UN Development Program's Regional Africa Bureau aims to address the reasons youth are attracted to such groups. The agency says violent extremism has had a devastating social and economic impact across the continent. Mohamed Yahya is the UNDP Regional Coordinator based in Addis Ababa.
Development becomes quite impossible in areas where violent extremism is growing and the activities are growing. Just to give you an example, we've seen in recent times that the tourism sector in Kenya has gone down by 25% because of the activities or the fears of Al-Shabaab. We have seen foreign direct investment in Nigeria be affected up to 21% because of the Boko Haram.
Violent extremism disrupts local livelihoods, such as selling goods at markets or going to the mosque, church, or school. Yahya says it's easier for militant groups to recruit the young if they're poor, unemployed, and with few prospects for a better life. Food, shelter, and a job are some of the lures used to adopt a violent ideology. Nevertheless, Yahya says that does not fully explain the attraction.
In our recent research, which is ongoing, by the way, we are looking at what is the tipping point. For example, why do two brothers of the same family, one joins extremist group, the other one doesn't? So there is still unknown answers in that sense. We're doing a thorough research and looking into that.
He describes what he calls a cocktail of reasons why young Africans may feel disenfranchised.
Growth of youth populations coupled with lack of opportunity, exclusion, coupled with the attractiveness of this venomous ideology that the radicals sell, coupled with issues around marginalization, political marginalization of minority groups, all this comes together, unfortunately, pushes some of our youth to join these extremist groups.
Yahya says extremism is an unwelcome import to the continent.
This is not indigenous problem to Africa. It was imported from other parts of the world. So we will work with the African Union, economic communities such as IGAD and ECOWAS, to look at how do we create a coordinated regional approach to deal with the problems.
The UNDP has identified three categories of countries where the anti-extremism program could be implemented.
What we call epicenter countries, such as Mali, Somalia, Nigeria, where these groups have well established themselves, and also working at other set of countries where we call them spillover countries. Countries like Cameroon and Kenya are suffering from the problems of neighboring countries, and then looking at countries that are at risk.
It will also take aim at the ideological attraction of militant groups, what Yahya calls a struggle of ideas. This could be done, he says, through mosques, madrasas, and the internet. The initiative also seeks to reform some formal institutions.
How do the police forces respond in a way that doesn't increase the resentment and doesn't exacerbate the problem? How do we ensure prisons don't become a platform for recruitment? How do we ensure that our religious organizations have the right governance system so that the mosques are not taken over, or religious institutions are not taken over, that communities themselves are able to be at the forefront in providing solution and become a bulwark against extremist activities?
The four-year initiative, The Preventing and Responding to Violent Extremism in Africa, a Development Approach, will cost more than $45 million. The UN was not alone in putting the initiative together. It was joined by the African Union, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, faith groups, civil society, and donors. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up on 24 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The director of one of the few remaining independent newspapers in Burundi is being charged with conspiring with the leaders of a failed coup. Antoine Kaborahe is alleged to have talked on the telephone with General Cyril Ndeyirukiye a day before the general allegedly attempted to overthrow the government of President Pierre Nkurunziza last May. But the general has been arrested, but others involved in the coup remain at large. Most of Burundi's independent journalists have fled the country since violence erupted in May. Street protests and clashes between political opponents, civil society groups, and police and ruling party youth members have left more than 240 people dead. The UN says more than 200,000 people have fled the country. The political crisis began when President Nkurunziza chose to run for a third term as president, despite local and international donor opposition. They called the move unconstitutional.
In
The Islamic State today claims responsibility for an attack on a bus carrying Tunisian presidential guards yesterday. The explosion killed 13 people. The Islamic State claimed on their internet posting today that they killed 30 passengers. The bus was traveling through central Tunis when the explosion occurred. The explosion came 10 days after authorities increased security in Tunis and deployed security forces in high numbers. President Bedi Saeed Essebsi is holding an emergency meeting of his cabinet today. He has declared a 30-day national state of emergency and a curfew in the capital. Tunis. Speaking on national television, he said Tunisia is at war against terrorism and urged international cooperation against extremists. Earlier this month, Tunisian authorities announced the dismantling of a cell it said had planned attacks on police stations and hotels in a resort city about 150 kilometers southeast of Tunis. Tunisia's tourism industry has been hit hard this year by extremist attacks. Shootings at a luxury beach hotel in Sousse last June killed 38 people, mostly tourists. In March, an attack by Islamist extremists at Tunisia's famed Barado Museum near the capital killed 22 people. Treatment for HIV/AIDS is much more readily available in Africa now than it was a decade ago. Life expectancy has increased, but as we hear from health reporter R. Chimes, a new study finds that women are gaining more than men.
A new long-term study in South Africa has looked at the results of effective treatment for HIV/AIDS, called antiretroviral therapy, or ART, which became widely available in 2004. Jacob Bohr of the Boston University School of Public Health and his colleagues analyzed data collected in South Africa's KwaZulu-Natal province between 2001 and 2011. He says the scale-up of ART dramatically transformed people's lives. Death rates on the whole decreased, and people were living longer.
On the other hand, men seem to be benefiting less at the population level than women.
For example, in fewer than a dozen years, the life expectancy for women increased by more than 13 years, but men gained only 9 years of life expectancy. Why is that? Bohr says more than half the men who died of HIV/AIDS never sought treatment, even though free treatment was widely available. This suggests, he says, that better ways are needed to persuade men to get tested and treated.
Often when a man goes to a clinic, he's sitting in a room with dozens of women and is the only man there. And that can be an uncomfortable experience. And so male clinics are one idea that people have thought about.
Another approach, he says, is self-testing, where men can find out their HIV status in private. Also, Bohr points out that because a clinic doesn't charge a patient doesn't mean that the testing is really free. There are costs, like transportation or missing work, that also may deter men from getting tested and treated for HIV/AIDS. The research paper by Jacob Bohr and his colleagues is published in the journal PLOS Medicine. For VOA News, this is Art Chimes reporting.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali, coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Marty Curcius, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, Pope Francis travels to Africa. Making his first trip to the continent, the pontiff will visit Kenya, Uganda, and the Central African Republic in a pilgrimage that will bring him face to face with Islamic extremism and Christian-Muslim violence. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they discuss the significance of the Pope's mission next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.